Three Lives by Tuesday Lobsang Rampa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 10. The old monk painfully rose from the ground and dusted his faded robes. He looked with compassion at the hulking man climbing back over the fence separating the monastery ground from the public parkway. The man seemed to feel that the monk was looking at him. He turned around and stopped halfway across the fence, and he growled, "Cyrus Bollywugger, bud, that's me, top feature writer. If you want to make something of it, get a lawyer." The monk walked slowly to a rock and sat down with a heavy sigh. What a strange thing it was, he thought. He, an elderly monk, just walking in the garden of his monastic home for the last 50 years, and in spite of all the signs saying it was private property, this coarse, crude fellow had come clambering over and, in spite of the monk's protestations, had come up to him, prodded him in the chest with a thick forefinger. "Give us the lowdown, bud. What gives in this ear joint? You're all a lot of gays, eh? Well, you don't look too gay to me, but give us the lowdown. I gotta write an article." The old monk had looked the man up and down with rather more contempt than he thought he should have shown. It was not good to be so contemptuous of one's fellow man, but this one surely was beyond the limit. Old Brother Arnold had been here for years. He'd entered as a boy, lived here ever since, trying to reconcile the words of the Bible with what he felt to be right and wrong. He had been discussing with himself, as was his wont, what it was all about. He could not take everything as the literal truth which was in the Bible. Some time ago he had voiced certain doubts to the abbot, thinking that the abbot would help him to resolve his doubts and clear his mind, but no, the abbot had flown into a furious rage, and old Brother Arnold had penances for a whole week. Penances washing all the dishes for the monastery. Then, as now, after being assaulted by this crude media yokel, he had repeated one prayer to himself over and over. "Lord, in thy mercy, let nothing come too close nor seem too real." It calmed him, enabled him to gaze on things in an abstract manner. He had been wandering around, thinking of his past life. There was the work in the mornings and study in the afternoons, and so much illuminating to do. The paints, nowadays, were poor plastic things, awful paints, and the vellum, well, least said about the vellum, the better. It might be all right for lampshades, but for the top grade illumination for which he was noted, modern supplies were useless. And then, after the afternoon duties, what was there? The same day after day, week after week, month after month, and year after year. The vespers, and then supper in solitary silence, and after supper, compline, the completion of the seventh canonical hour. After that, the lonely cell, cold and draughty with a hard, narrow bed, and the inevitable crucifix at the head of the bed, a cell so small that even a convict in a prison would have gone on strike under such conditions. He had been walking around, thinking of that, and then this crude oaf had burst in to the private sanctuary, poking him in the chest, demanding that the old man should give him a sensational article. gays? Good heavens, no. Monks were not gays. They looked upon homosexuals with a certain amount of compassion, but with a total lack of understanding. The old man had stood his ground and ordered Cyrus Bollywogger off. This man had lost his temper. He had ranted on about the power of the press, saying that with his pen he could destroy the reputation of the monastery, and as the monk stood silent in his inner contemplation, Cyrus Bollywogger had suddenly raised a fist the size of a ham and struck the old man heavily in the chest, knocking him down. He lay there in a daze, wondering what ailed mankind nowadays. Why should a hulking lout like this strike a frail old man almost at the end of his life? He could not understand it. He lay there for a time. Then, slowly, painfully, he climbed on shaky legs to his unsteady feet and tottered to sit on a rock and to regain his equilibrium and composure. Yelling threats of exposure, Bollywogger finally jumped off the fence and dropped to the ground on the other side, moving off with a rapid, shambling gait reminiscent of an inebriated gorilla rather than a specimen of Homo sapiens. Brother Arnold sat there beside the sparkling sea, gazing out with unseeing eyes, with ears untroubled, hardly perceiving, in fact, the shouts and yells of merrymakers on the public beach, children screaming and quarreling, and shrill-voiced harridans cursing their men for some imagined slight. At last, old Arnold jumped. A hand had descended on his shoulder. A voice said, "What ails you, my brother?" He looked up to find another brother of equal age, gazing down upon him, concern in his brown eyes. "I've been insulted by a pressman who burst over our fence and struck me in the chest," said Brother Arnold. "He demanded that I tell him that we were all gays, homosexuals, in this monastery, and when I denied that with some acerbity, why, he struck me in the chest and knocked me to the ground. Since then, I have felt unwell, and I've had to rest a while. But come, let's return to the house." Stiffly he rose to his feet, and slowly the two old men who had been brothers in the monastery for many, many years wandered up the path toward the great building that was their home. That night, after Compline, when the monks were in their cells, Brother Arnold felt considerable pain. He felt that his chest was being penetrated with hot spears. Feebly, he used a sandal and banged upon the wall of his cell. There was a rustle, and a voice came from outside his door. "What is it, brother? Are you ill?" Brother Arnold replied in a feeble voice, "Yes, brother. Will you ask Father Infirmarian if he can come and see me?" There was a muttered acknowledgment and the sound of shuffling sandals upon the stone floor. It was strange, thought Brother Arnold, that no one monk could enter the cell of another monk, not even from the purest motives. None other except Father Infirmarian could enter, and then only in the pursuit of his medical duties. Was there something in it? Are some monks homosexual? Possibly, maybe, he thought. Certainly the authorities had enough rules and regulations to make sure that no two monks were together, and they could only go about in threes. Brother Arnold lay upon his bed of pain and thought about the matter until he was aroused by the opening of his cell door and a gentle voice asking, "Brother Arnold, what ails you?" And so Brother Arnold told of the events of the afternoon, told of the blow upon his chest and of falling. Father Infirmarian had been a fully qualified doctor of medicine who had given up the practice of medicine in disgust, not being able any longer to take part in the various rackets which pervaded medical science of the present age. Carefully, he parted Brother Arnold's clothing and examined his chest, which was now black and blue and yellow, and then his trained eyes picked out Brother Arnold had some broken ribs. Carefully, he recovered the old man's chest, rose to his feet, and said, "I must go to Father Superior and give a report on this, Brother Arnold. You have broken bones. You need X-ray, and you need hospital treatment." With that, he turned and went out silently. Soon there came more shuffling noises and very low-toned voices in the corridor outside. His door was opened, and Father Infirmarian and Father Superior entered and looked down upon him. "Brother Arnold," said the Superior, "you'll have to go to the hospital to be X-rayed and to have your ribs set and put in a cast. I will go and inform Father Abbott so that he may make the necessary arrangements. In the meantime, Father Infirmarian will stay with you here in case he can do anything for you." The father turned to leave the cell, but Brother Arnold cried, "No, Father Superior, Father Superior, I do not want to go to the hospital. I've heard so much of the malpractice there, and I would rather be treated by Father Infirmarian. And if I am beyond his capacity, then I will commend my soul to God." "No, that will not do, Brother Arnold. I cannot accept that. Only Father Abbott can make a dispensation on this case. I'll go and see him," said the Superior as he left the cell. There was little Father Infirmarian could do to help the aged brother, but he moistened a cloth and wiped the old man's brow to try to reduce the fever somewhat. Again, he undid Brother Arnold's vestments so that not even that weight should cause further difficulty. Together they sat, for the old man was half sitting in his bed now, it being easier for him to breathe in that posture. Soon there came footsteps again. The cell door opened, and in came Father Abbott. The Superior had to wait outside, for the cells were so small that they could not take more than two people when one was on a bed. Father Abbott came and looked down at Brother Arnold, and his face showed horror and shock at the state of the old man's chest. There was a low-voiced discussion between Father Abbott and Father Infirmarian, and then the abbot turned to Brother Arnold, saying, "I cannot accept the responsibility, Brother Arnold, of keeping you here in this condition. You will have to go to the hospital." He stopped for a moment and pursed his lower lip between finger and thumb in deep thought. After some moments, he looked at Brother Arnold again and said, "In view of your condition, in view of your age, I will, if you wish, Brother Arnold, telephone for the bishop, and then we can only accept his ruling." "I am very loath to leave this, my home, for the unknown perils of hospitals as they are of this day. I've heard so much against them that I have no confidence, and without confidence I should not benefit from their treatment. My whole faith is with Father Infirmarian." "As you will, Brother Arnold," said Father Abbott. "I should not say this in your hearing, but I cannot help agreeing with you." The abbot left the cell, and he and the superior went away toward the abbot's office, where minutes after he could be heard telephoning the bishop of the diocese in which the monastery was located. There were frequent, "As you say, Father Bishop, as you say, yes, I will do that, goodbye," and there was the sound of the telephone being replaced on its cradle. Father Abbott sat in silence for a while, and then, upon a sudden decision, he sent for a scribe who came to take dictation and to prepare a paper which Brother Arnold would have to sign, saying that if he refused to leave the monastery for a hospital, he did so upon his own responsibility, and the monastery could not be held responsible for whatever occurred as a result of that decision. The monastery gleamed cold and white in the brilliant light of the moon. Light scurrying clouds hurrying across the face of the moon somehow lent a sinister air to the monastic building. Moonlight reflecting brightly from the many windows glittered and seemed to wink at the clouds as they scudded by. Somewhere a night owl called loudly in the darkness. Nearby there was the gentle hiss of waves lapping the sand, reaching up higher and withdrawing to form the next wave. In the monastery itself, all was quiet, hushed as though even the building knew that death was at hand, as if it were waiting for the beating of the wings of the angel of death. Occasionally there came all those strange sounds which occur in an old building which is feeling the weight of the years. Every so often there came the scurrying pit-a-pat of little mouse feet running across the polished floors, and sometimes a frightened squeak from a mouse. But the building was still and as silent as an old building can ever be. Then, from the clock tower, the hours rang out across the listening countryside. From the distance there came the roar of a train speeding along on its iron rails towards the metropolis. Brother Arnold lay upon his bed of pain. By the light of the flickering candle, he could see Father Infirmarian gazing upon him with compassion. Suddenly, so suddenly as to make Brother Arnold jump, Father Infirmarian spoke. "Brother Arnold, we've been so concerned about you, about your future. Sometimes you have beliefs which are so different from those of the Orthodox religion. You seem to think it doesn't matter what you believe, so long as you believe. Brother Arnold, at this late stage, repent, repent. Let your shriving take place. Shall I call the Father Confessor for you, Brother Arnold?" Brother Arnold looked about him and said, "Father Infirmarian, I am satisfied with my way of life. I go to what I believe will be heaven. I go according to my own belief, not necessarily a belief according to a book. I believe that our prescribed religion, the Orthodox religion, is narrow in its concepts." He gasped as pain racked his body. He felt as though his chest was on fire. He felt as though nails were being driven through his chest, and he thought of the nails driven through the hands and feet of Christ. He thought of the pain of the thrust in the body caused by the guard below the crucifix. "Father Infirmarian, Father Infirmarian," he called, "will you pass me the crucifix that I may kiss the 5 wounds? Slowly, Father Infirmarian rose to his feet and moved to the head of Brother Arnold's bed. Reaching up after crossing himself, he touched the crucifix, lifted it down, and pressed it to Brother Arnold's lips. "Father Infirmarian! Father Infirmarian!" cried Arnold in anguish and amazement. "Who are all these people who have gathered about me? Ah, I see, here is my mother. She's come to bid me welcome to the greater reality, the greater life. My mother is here. My father is here. Many friends of mine are here." Very quickly, Father Infirmarian rose to his feet, moved to the door, rapped suddenly and sharply on the door of the next cell. There was a startled exclamation from within, and almost on the instant, a shaven-headed monk appeared around the opening door. "Quick, quick," said Father Infirmarian, "call Father Abbot. Brother Arnold is about to leave us." The monk did not stop to don a robe nor put on his sandals. He sped down the corridor and leapt down the stairs. Soon he returned, following Father Abbot, who had been waiting alone in his study. Brother Arnold looked about him wildly and exclaimed in anguish, "Why is it that we who preach religion are afraid to die? Why is it, Father Abbot? Why is it that we're so afraid to die?" An answer appeared in Brother Arnold's brain. "You will learn that, Arnold, when you come to us on the other side of life. You will be coming shortly." The Father Abbot knelt beside the bed, holding the crucifix in his upraised hands. He prayed. He prayed for mercy upon the soul of Brother Arnold, who had so often departed from the prescribed script of religion. Beside the bed, the guttering candle flared and went low. A vagrant breeze caught the flame and turned it into black carbon. It flared again, and in the light of that lone candle, they saw Brother Arnold raise up, crying, "Nunc Dimittis, Nunc Dimittis, Lord, now lettest thou thy servant depart in peace according to thy word." With that, he groaned and fell back lifeless against the pillows. Father Infirmarian crossed himself and said a prayer for the passing of the dead. Then, reaching over the head of Father Abbot, who was still upon his knees, Father Infirmarian closed the eyes of Brother Arnold and put little pads upon them to keep them closed. He put a band beneath the lower jaw and held the gaping mouth shut. Then he tied the band onto the top of Brother Arnold's tonsured head. Carefully, he raised the dead monk's head and shoulders and removed the pillows. He took Brother Arnold's hands and crossed them upon his chest. Lower, he attended to the necessary toilet, and then the sheet was pulled up over Brother Arnold's dead face. Slowly, Father Abbot rose to his feet and went out of the lonely cell, went to his own office, and instructed a monk. Minutes later, there came the tolling of the bell to signal the passing from life to death. Silently, the monks rose from their beds and donned their robes and filed down to the chapel to recite the service for the dead. Later, when the sun was rising above the horizon, there would be a mass which all would attend, and then the body of Brother Arnold, wrapped in his robe and with his cowl covering his face, with his hands about the crucifix on his chest, would be carried in solemn procession from the monastery down the garden path and into the little consecrated patch which held so many of the bodies of the monks from times long gone. Even now, two monks were preparing to go out to the consecrated patch and dig the grave facing the sea, in which Brother Arnold's body would rest until its final dissolution. The two monks went out with spades upon their shoulders, silent, each thinking, wondering maybe, what was beyond this life. Holy Writ taught us much, but could Holy Writ be depended upon exactly, precisely? Brother Arnold had always said, to the anger of Father Abbot, that one could not take Holy Writ too seriously. It was only a pointer of the way, only as a guide, as a signpost. Brother Arnold had often said that the life hereafter was merely a continuation of the life on earth. Brother Arnold had been sitting silent and still some time ago in the refectory. Before him was an unopened bottle of aerated water. Suddenly he had risen to his feet, grasped the bottle in his hands and said, "Look, my brothers, this bottle resembles the human body. In it we have a soul. As I take the cap off of this bottle, there's bubbling. There's turmoil in the water in the bottle, and the gases, like unto the soul of a human, burst forth. That is how, my brothers," he said, "we leave our bodies at the termination of this life. Our bodies are but clothing to the immortal soul, and when the clothing is old and tattered and no longer able to hold together, then the soul relinquishes the body and it goes elsewhere. For what happens elsewhere? Well, my brothers, each of us and every one of us will discover that in his turn." Brother Arnold had tipped the contents of the bottle into a glass and drank it swiftly, saying, "Now the body, which was the water, has disappeared, just as the body, which is our body, will eventually disappear into the earth, and there be resolved at last into its component parts." The two monks thought of that as they walked down the path and looked around for a suitable patch in which to dig the grave, 6 feet deep by 6 feet long, 3 feet wide. Without a word, they set to work, carefully removing the turf and putting it aside so that later it might be used to cover a new grave. In the monastery, the body of Brother Arnold was being moved before rigor mortis supervened, because that would have made bending the body around the curves of stairs difficult. 4 monks had a canvas sheet with handles at each corner. Carefully, they slid it under the body of Brother Arnold and positioned his body exactly in the middle of the canvas sheet. Carefully, they drew the sides of the sheet up so that the handles at the top and bottom could interlock. the head end interlock together and the foot end interlock together. Carefully, the monks lifted the body off the bed. Carefully, they maneuvered it out through the doorway of the cell, and with a little struggle, they managed to get it turned in the corridor. Moving slowly and reciting the set phrases of the ritual for the dead, they carried the body down the stairs and into the chapel annex. Reverently, they placed the body on the bier, arranged the robes to fall naturally, and, placing sandals upon the dead man's feet, carefully they replaced the crucifix between the dead hands. Carefully they drew down the cowl to cover the features. Then the four monks began their solitary vigil, guarding the body of their dead brother until there would come the light of day, when again masses would be sung. And so Brother Arnold left his body. He felt that he was being borne upwards. Looking down with some trepidation, he found a silvery blue cord stretching from his present body to the pallid, ghastly corpse resting on the bed below. About him he could half distinguish faces. Surely that was his mother. And there was his father. They had come from beyond the shades to help him, to guide him on his journey. The way ahead was dark. It seemed to be a long, endless tunnel. A tunnel, or maybe a tube. It seemed to be something like the tube which the monks carried in procession through the village on certain occasions. A tube supported by a pole, which they raised up against windows so that people could give their contributions to the mouth of the tube, and it would slide down to a collection bag below. Brother Arnold felt himself moving slowly up this tube. It was a most peculiar feeling. He turned his head down and saw that the silver cord was thinning, and even as he looked, the cord parted and was no more. It seemed like a ribbon of elastic, which, cut, withdrew under its own elasticity. Above him, as he peered upwards, there seemed to be a bright light. He was reminded of when he had gone down the monastery well to help clear the water filters below. Looking up, he had seen the bright circle of light which illuminated the top of the well. He had a similar feeling now. The feeling was that he was being borne upwards, upwards to the light, and he wondered, what now? Suddenly, like a stage devil appearing through a trap, Arnold appeared where? He appeared on this other world, or in another plane of existence? He did not know what it was for the moment. The light was so intense that he had to cover his eyes, and after a few moments he cautiously lifted his hands away from his eyes and uttered a weak, "Oh my," at the sight before him. There came an amused chuckle by his side, and he turned and gazed at the one who used to be his father. "Well, Arnold," said the other, "you certainly seem astonished. I should have thought you would have remembered it all, although I must say that it took me long enough." He gave a rueful smile. Arnold gazed around. "Well, I certainly am astonished," he said. "This place appears to be like Earth. Oh, a much better version of it, I grant you, but it does appear to be an Earth-type world, and I thought we would be going to, well, I don't know quite what, but to a more abstract type of world, not this." He gestured at the buildings and the parklands. This does look like a frightfully posh version of Earth. Arnold, you have quite a lot to learn, or to relearn, said his former father. Your own studies, your own long experience, should have led you to the conviction that if an entity, a human soul, went direct from the earth world up to high celestial spheres, then it would be entirely to destroy that entity's sanity. The change would be so great. He looked hard at Arnold and said, Think of a glass, an ordinary glass tumbler, if you like. You cannot place a cold glass straight into very hot water. It would fracture. And there are many things of a like nature. It must be done gently, gently. In the same way, with a person who's been ill for a long time and confined to bed, you don't expect him to get out of bed one day and walk around and run around as if he were a well-trained athlete. Well, it's the same here. You were upon a crude, crude world, the earth. You were on the upward climb, and here's an intermediate stage, let us say, a halt where one can pause a while and get one's bearings. Arnold looked around, marveling at the beauty of the buildings, marveling at the green of the greenery and the trees without blemish. Here, he saw, animals and birds were in no way afraid of humans. This seemed to be a world of good rapport. Soon, I have no doubt, you will be going up to higher planes, but before that can be decided, you have to go to the Hall of Memories. When there, you may recover your flagging memory of your visit here before. I am quite amused at the way we say up, said Arnold. I thought the heavenly spheres and the earth spheres, or planes of existence, call them what you will, were intermingled and perhaps even occupied the same space, so why say up? Another man broke in. He'd been watching, but saying nothing, and now he remarked mildly, Well, it is up. There's no doubt about it. We go up to a higher vibration. If we were going to go to a lower vibration, then we should be going down. And in fact, there are such places of lower vibration, and people here who have to go down there for some reason, perhaps to help a weary soul, would soon say that he or she was going down to plane so-and-so. But this is an intermediate stage. We come up to it from the earth. We want to get away from the earth. And if we were going down, then you could say we were getting nearer to the earth's core. And that's what you do not want to do. So, up it is, up to a higher vibration, up to get away from the center of the earth, and soon you, Arnold, will be going up again. Of that I have no doubt. For this is just an intermediate stage. People from here go up to a higher plane, or they go down to the earth again to learn more lessons. But now, it's time you went to the Hall of Memories. Everyone must go there first. Come this way. Together they walked along what seemed to be very well-kept street. There were no cars, no mechanically propelled vehicles of any kind. People walked, and the animals walked as well, often alongside the humans. Soon Arnold and his new friend turned away from the streets and entered a little lane, at the end of which Arnold could see much greenery. He walked along with the other, both concerned about their own thoughts. Soon they came to the end of the little lane, and there was a beautiful, beautiful park ahead of them, with wonderful plants, wonderful flowers, of a type which Arnold had never seen before. And there, in the center of the park, was the great domed structure, which the people termed the Hall of Memories. They stood a while, taking in the picture, the greenery, the vivid colors of the flowers, and the very brilliant blue of the skies, which were reflected brightly on the surface of the placid lake near the Hall of Memories. As of one accord, Arnold and his new friend stepped upon the path leading to the hall. They walked along, wondering perhaps about the other people who were sitting on benches or lying on the grass. Frequently they would see a person mount the steps to the Hall of Memories, and they would see others coming out from some hidden exit. Some were looking elated. Some were looking chastened beyond expression. Arnold looked and gave an anticipatory shudder at the strangeness of it all. What happened in the Hall of Memories? What would happen to him? Would he pass muster? Would he go up to a higher vibration, to a more abstract form of life? Or would he be sent down to earth to start another life all over again? "Look, look," murmured Arnold's new friend. He nudged Arnold and pointed in a certain direction. His voice sank to a whisper as he said, "These are entities from a much higher plane of existence. They've come to observe the people. Look at them." Arnold looked, and he saw two bright golden spheres. They seemed to be made of light. They were so brilliant that Arnold could not even guess at the true shape. The golden spheres were drifting along like golden bubbles in the light breeze. They drifted along and came to the walls of the Hall of Memories. They touched and went straight through without leaving a mark on the structure. "I must leave you now," said Arnold's friend, "but keep cheerful. You have nothing to worry about, that's for sure. Goodbye. There'll be someone here to meet you when you come out. Cheer up, don't look so mournful." With that, he turned abruptly and retraced his steps. Arnold, with mounting apprehension, no, with complete fright, plodded on to the end of the path to where the entrance to the Hall of Memories began. At the foot of the great stone steps he stopped and tried to look around to see what was happening, but no, he did not stop at all. Some force was propelling him, drawing him. He hurried up the steps and stopped a moment before the great entrance door. Suddenly, silently, it opened, and Arnold was pushed inside. Pushed or dragged inside, it does not matter which. He was inside, and the door shut behind him. End of chapter 10.